We hear the phrase business monopoly and immediately envision mega companies gaining power, raising prices, shoddy products, a loss of competition, and generally consumer abuse. Thus, since the late 1800s, a time of large-scale business enterprise, antitrust regulations have been written and revised with the intent of stemming the tide of monopoly power, restoring effective competition to the market economy, and protecting the consumer. But in today's world, heading for the 21st century, have the antitrust laws and regulations accomplished this, or are they just one more factor contributing to the death of small business? Welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Joan Ziemba at George Mason University, the State University in Northern Virginia. New economic research on potential monopolistic abuses and antitrust regulations as the effective cure indicate that the enforcement of antitrust laws may have killed business initiative, may have made the economy less efficient, and may be a contributing factor to the steady decline of business productivity in America. Where the antitrust laws once protected the consumer, they now protect competitors from each other. With us today to look at business versus the antitrust laws are Richard Fink, economist and director of the Center for the Study of Market Processes at George Mason University, and Don LaVoy, an economics professor at George Mason, center faculty member, and editor of the scholarly newsletter Market Process. Welcome to Frankly Speaking. Our growth market, as well as our economic structure, have changed considerably since the antitrust laws were developed. What does antitrust mean today, Rick?
Antitrust is enforced by the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, and its goal is essentially to try to protect the consumer from what is perceived as abusive practices by various businesses. So the basic idea is focused on making sure that business consistently acts in the consumer's interest and does not take advantage of consumers who are thought to be in a position of having less knowledge about business activities and therefore liable to be exploited.
In practice, however, we would make a case that these aims are not being accomplished, in fact, maybe never have been accomplished. And I think our conclusions of this are not so much due to changes in antitrust law or their enforcement themselves, but rather changes in our economic theory, which has us look at these laws in a different way.
What is the center's research discovering in this area?
Our research essentially, it's an ongoing research, but essentially we found out that the consumer is actually the victim of antitrust policies. And rather than being protected and somehow having their general welfare promoted by restricting a number of different economic activities, consumers are actually suffering by current antitrust policies. In particular, as it restricts businesses from putting certain products on the market in certain ways that consumers really value.
Since the original intent was to protect the consumer and a strong antitrust policy make the market economy more competitive and efficient, why isn't that working?
The original philosophy was that consumer and business interests are somehow antithetical. Therefore, business was viewed with skepticism and suspicion, rather than viewing business as a means of servicing the consumer and seeing how business provide products to the consumer. Business practices were viewed as exploitive originally without looking into their real function.
I think a lot of the problem was in even the way competition was viewed. Economists were thinking of competition in a very static sense, that is, there's some world of perfect or ideal competition which we want to approximate, and we're trying to use antitrust laws as a way of shaping the competitive structure into a form that looks more like what the economic theory thought would be ideal. However, in current work in economics, there's much more of a stress on processes of change or the dynamics of economics as opposed to viewing this static world. And from this different view of competition, we're beginning to see that maybe the antitrust laws are not really bringing us to a more competitive world after all.
Okay, when you say processes of change, what do you mean by that?
Well, for example, if you think of a competitive act by a businessman, you're thinking of some innovation that he's trying to introduce into the market to try to, in a sense, grab a new share of the market, if you want to look at it from a from a negative point of view, or you could say, you know, from a more positive point of view, that they're trying to help consumers in a way that none of the existing competitors have thought of. But this, believe it or not, this is exactly the sort of thing that is condemned by standard economic theory, or it had been anyway, that anything that is done to change or to introduce some new aspect of a product is thought of as an anti-competitive act. So, for example, product differentiation has been attacked by antitrust lawyers, and yet that may be one of the main ways that a new competitor can try to satisfy his consumers by differentiating his product from those that are already on the market.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that the economic theory behind our antitrust policy is based on what we call this Nirvana fallacy, and that is economists have developed a picture of what competition would be like in a perfect world, or heaven, economic heaven. And you find that in economic heaven, all consumers have perfect knowledge, all efficient techniques are known, and none of the real business problems that people face today exist. They then go out and examine the real world and find that it comes up dismally short. Okay. Then the goal is for antitrust policy to take the real world and move it closer to heaven. Okay. Our approach is fundamentally different. We're saying, let's forget heaven. Okay. Let's deal with the real world and look at the real problems that people face. There's imperfect knowledge. Businessmen do not know what the most efficient techniques. A matter of fact, their whole function is to try to find out this knowledge. Their whole function is to solve the problems that are already assumed away in the models that are used as a basis for antitrust policy.
What's been the effect of antitrust regulations on small business in this country?
I think one thing that comes to mind is that many of the provisions of antitrust, which seem on the face of them to be clearly directed at big business and at keeping big business from hurting smaller businesses, are in fact, in practice, hurting the smaller businesses. And for example, think of a law that prohibits a large corporation from acquiring a lot of smaller companies. Now, to the normal person, that sounds like you're helping out the little guy because you're keeping him from being swallowed up by some giant firm. However, what it really does is it prevents the small businessman from selling out any of his assets to someone else who's already in the market and more established. So in other words, it adds risk to the situation of a small businessman who would, if he were allowed to sell out his assets, if it turns out he loses, could in fact launch many different businesses and feel free to take chances, because he could always, if worse came to worse, he could always sell out to an IBM. Whereas now, with this sort of law that makes it so difficult for a larger corporation to buy out the smaller ones, many businessmen will not even try to enter a market on the knowledge that if they fail, they are the ones who take all the losses, and many of their assets will just become worthless. So I think even some of these laws that appear to help small business and hurt big business will, in their practice, actually hurt the smaller business.
Could you give us an example?
Yeah, I think a recent case by the Federal Trade Commission against Cuisinart is an excellent example. In the early 70s, one entrepreneur, a single entrepreneur, developed a food processor, the first food processor introduced in the United States. Soon after, eight very large companies developed similar products and entered into competition with Cuisinart. Now, Cuisinart was very, very small in relation to its competitors, but it had the best product on the market and by far had the dominant market share. It was sort of viewed as the Rolls-Royce of food processors. And through a particular distribution system where Cuisinart monitored how the food processor was produced and how it was sold at both the wholesale and retail level, it enabled itself to get wide distribution, to get into department stores and other retail avenues generally restricted to very large producers. So Cuisinart, in our view, is a paragon of competition, just an excellent example of the types of entrepreneurial activity that the health of our economy rests on. Well, Cuisinart was prosecuted, actually faced criminal charges because of its marketing practice, the very marketing practice that allowed it to introduce a new product and be successful against very, very large competitors. Okay. Cuisinart, rightly so from its own interest, signed a consent decree and decided not to pursue this distribution. Okay. And this type of activity is what discourages a lot of small businesses from entering into competition with large businesses, because the types of practices that allow them to succeed are the very ones that they get prosecuted for.
There were a few other examples, I think pretty similar situations, with cereals, with beer manufacturers.
One of my recent favorites is a Coors brewery. Coors has been in existence for over 100 years. And Coors, in 1948, was something like the 79th largest brewer. And through the next 15 or 20 years, it was able to grow into the fourth largest brewer because it had the highest quality beer on the market. Even the FTC, when they prosecuted Coors, recognized that Coors had the highest quality product. Absolutely no question about it. How they maintain that high quality is they grew their own raw materials, they made their own equipment, and they monitored that beer from the time it left their shop to the time it reached the consumer. And it had to be refrigerated at all points along the way. Mm-hmm. No other beer was so meticulous in quality control as Coors. Okay, the very distribution system that allowed Coors to maintain this quality is the very practice that they were prosecuted for and had to discontinue. So the practice that allowed Coors to service more consumers to provide the highest quality beer in the United States is the very practice that they now had to stop.
We live with what are called legal monopolies. What's the distinction between government-created monopolies or legal cartels and market monopolies?
Well, historically, we've seen that almost all monopolies are created by the government, and that is those monopolies that do tend to have power over prices and indiscriminate power are those that are granted government privileges that prevent other people from competing with them. Market monopolies are extremely rare, and many people would say that the term really doesn't apply to a market organization. But generally, firms that become dominant because of their market position is because they offer a better product to consumers. Let's an IBM, for example, if it were to receive no government favors, would have arrived at their position by building the best mousetrap, okay, or the best computer in the industry. And that means that they're serving consumers better than anyone else. So they've achieved a dominant position in the economy. And that's something that's very good from an economic standpoint. Whereas a government monopoly, let's say AT&T or the post office, has not achieved their dominant position because of efficiency, but because of special privileges, because the government has prevented other entrepreneurs from competing with
them. Are they subject to the same antitrust laws?
No, most of the time they're exempt from these same antitrust laws.
Theories on the effectiveness of antitrust laws have been popular for some time. What's now causing this new analysis and research?
I think it's this whole trend in economic thought that Don mentioned before of young economists like ourselves here at the center trying to get away from the static equilibrium or heaven approach and actually get into the world and see how human beings really act and what problems they face. And when you take this more realistic or process approach, it really changes the whole scope of economic inquiry.
Today we've taken a look at the country's antitrust policies and how they may be affecting small business and free enterprise in the 20th century. I'd like to thank Richard Fink and Donald Lavoie for being with us today. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public service program produced by George Mason University. For more information about our guests or this program, call area code 703-323-2138. I'm Joan Ziemba for George Mason University, the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you for listening.